You are listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 30th of January 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello from Studio One in London and welcome to Midori House with me, Markus Hippi. On today's show, from the Geneva 2 talks to the Washington Post's newsroom, we'll review the day's top stories with Rachel Sharby and Stuart Purvis. Then we'll take the pulse of the Spanish art scene with the founders of the Atelier de Jeune project.
I think it's changing, it's more modern, it's starting to grow a lot, and art is starting to be something that people want to know about and want to learn.
We'll also check in with our man in Nairobi and we'll chat about books with Parul Segal from the New York Times Book Review. All that and much more right here on Midori House with me, Markus Hippi. So, lots coming up in the next hour here on Midori House, but before all that, here is David Spencer with the latest news.
Thank you, Monocle 24 News. I'm David Spencer. The United States says Syria must ensure it keeps to the agreed timetable for the removal of chemical weapons materials from the country. US Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel's warning comes with the weapons due to be destroyed under an international deal. His comments follow a report that less than 5% of the arsenal has been delivered to the port of Latakia and that work to destroy the weapons has fallen behind schedule. Ukrainian President Viktor Yanukovych has delivered a defiant message to opposition politicians from his sickbed. He's accused them of continuing to whip up the political crisis, despite the authorities taking steps to appease their concerns. The statement came hours after the presidential office said he's on sick leave with an acute respiratory ailment. On Wednesday night, a bill was passed granting a conditional amnesty for activists detained in the recent unrest, while on Tuesday the Prime Minister offered his resignation. At least 18 people have been killed after suicide bombers attacked a ministry building in the Iraqi capital, Baghdad. Four bombers detonated their explosives vest during the assault, a fifth was shot dead by security forces, and the last died shortly after being shot, according to security officials. A further 50 people were wounded in the attack. Russian authorities say they've identified the suicide bombers responsible for two attacks that killed 34 people in the city of Volgograd last month. They've arrested two suspected accomplices in the violence-plagued Dagestan province. Meanwhile, in Moscow, Amnesty International has delivered a petition to the Russian presidential administration, calling on the authorities to repeal the legislation restricting legitimate protests. A ballerina danced in sub-zero temperatures in support of the petition, and spokeswoman Kate Allen explained the significance.
I think it is a very beautiful picture. It's a picture of, in our minds, of civil society that has been manacled, but is still fighting back. And what we have seen in just the few hours that we've been in Russia is a really vibrant civil society that is feeling under huge pressure, that is being castigated as foreign agents, that is being brought before courts, being stopped from doing what they're doing.
Nine people have died in a house fire in rural western Kentucky. 11 people lived at the property in a town in a remote part of the state, about 209 kilometres from Louisville. The two other residents are being treated in hospital. Trooper Stu Reck is from Kentucky State Police.
Inside the scene, it is still hot. And so as far as trying to recover any remaining bodies or anything like that, it's going to take a while before our investigators can get in there and then try to do that, also to look for a cause or see if they can locate a cause or maybe an origin for the start of the fire.
The U.S. government has raised the amount it's seeking in penalties from Bank of America after a jury found that the bank was liable for fraud over defective mortgages sold by its countrywide unit. The request is for $2.1 billion. And is based on gross revenue generated by the fraud, according to the government. The Justice Department had previously asked for $863.6 million. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you. We will get more news headlines from David Spencer in 25 minutes. You are listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. We are back right after this.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette er Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. Se on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 です.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
You are listening to Midori House. The time here in London is 18.05 and it is 13.05 in New York. Joining me now with their take on the news here in the studio is Rachel Shabi, journalist and author of Not the Enemy, Israel's Jews from Arab Lands, and Stuart Purvis, professor of journalism at City University in London. Welcome to the programme, both of you.
Thank you.
Let's start in Syria, where what we should perhaps have expected all along is now official. The destruction of chemical weapons has stalled, or at least it's not taking place as fast as it should. A Reuters report today announces that only 5% of the chemical arsenal has been given up, and now it looks like Damascus is going to miss its next deadline, sending all the toxic agents abroad for destruction. How surprised are you by this news? Rachel first.
Not that surprised, although you sort of expected better, didn't you? I mean, this whole deal was such a sort of bolt from the blue, an unexpected breakthrough negotiated by Russia and the States, and it was really so encouraging and such a positive sign, especially kind of hand in hand with the sort of the thaw of the deep freeze of relationships between the US and Iran, and then at the same time the Geneva II, the next round of the Geneva Convention, Syria talks, which we've just had. It all looks so good, and now it looks like Syria is just kind of not really taking it seriously, which we expected, I suppose. But the real test here will be whether Syria's backers take this seriously, i.e. Russia, if they've gone to the trouble of brokering this deal, are they actually going to back it up and say to Syria, look, come on, you need to take this seriously or there will be consequences?
Stuart, what are your thoughts on this?
Well, I think it's time-wasting. I was at a soccer match in London last night where the weaker team had some brilliant time-wasting tactics. And I kind of, I feel the same thing. But they always timed them just so at the moment they were going to get a yellow card, they would sort of back off. I think that's what's going on here. They're trying sort of to delay the process. And to take the sporting metaphor perhaps a bit step too far, as Rachel said, we've got Geneva too. That's almost like as another pitch. So they're playing these two games, probably playing them in as one. If we're going to make a gesture here, we better not make a gesture there. And in a sense, they're going to drag this out as long as they need to. I doubt whether anyone, particularly the Russians, is going to show them a yellow card at any point.
It is indeed true that it was easy to be optimistic in the situation when it seems that something is actually happening. But on the other hand, when you think of clearing a country of chemical weapons while it is at war, it's quite tricky, isn't it?
Yeah, well, that's the argument that the Syrian regime has used of as to why it's been so slow. They've said, well, actually, it's been really hard to logistically do this because there's not enough kind of protection of the people who are actually executing the removal. Now, that may or may not be true, to be fair. The Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, which is enacting this removal, has yet to say actually that is true or no, that's complete nonsense and a time-wasting device. The other issue is that there was a lot of international stalling over what would actually happen with these the chemical stockpile once removed. It's one thing to take it away, but no great surprise, nobody actually wants to take it in. So it's like, where do you do it? How do you destroy it? And I think that the international stalling stalling over that perhaps gave the Syrian regime another kind of get-out hook. So there's been lots of factors that might account for the readiness with which the regime has been stalling. And it would be good to clear those up so that we can see what's really going on.
You already mentioned earlier that it's going to be interesting to see the reaction from Syria's backers. What do you actually see happening next? In principle, a failure to eliminate its chemical weapons could expose Syria to sanctions.
Yes, but as I say, I think you've got to see it now in the wider context. And if the Syrians are seen to have been, you know, being reasonably helpful at Geneva, then there will be an argument. Well, you know, we don't want to discourage them at Geneva by being too hard on over this. So I'm sure, as Rachel says, there were bound to be lots of reasons, and some of them may be true. So it's quite difficult as a sort of carrot and stick here. Well, if we let them get away with that, but we want something back from in return from Geneva. So, I mean, they always said that it was going to take a year to do. I think they got less than a year to do it. So they've got their kind of defence in first, and maybe they're proving that they're always right. It's going to take longer than was planned.
Geneva 2 talks are about to end. What is your impression about what's been going on over there? Have you seen any progress?
I think the fact that they are taking place is huge progress. And I know there's this kind of tendency to say, oh, it's just, you know, it's just for the sake of showmanship. It doesn't mean anything. But actually, I do think the fact that the two sides were together in the same room says a lot. The fact that the international community got it together enough to get its kind of clients in the same room was significant. And I think there was a New York Times article a few days ago that was saying, look, this is groundbreaking in the sense that actually the Syrian opposition is able to meet with and challenge members of the Syrian regime in a way that they would never be able to do actually in Syria without, you know, being locked away. And that in itself was a big step.
Do you agree, Stuart?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, if you look back at some of the even longer-running sagas, some of which have happily come to an end, Northern Ireland, South Africa, and clearly in the Palestinian issue, it took forever to get people in the same room.
Yeah.
So the fact that they went into the same room and, have come out without fighting, as far as we know, without killing each other, is got to be a small step.
But how is the situation going to improve by having these people in the same room if they actually don't manage to agree on anything?
Okay, but they have managed to agree on some things. They're talking about things like humanitarian corridors and evacuating women and children from areas. And they are beginning to talk about a transitional process. Now, yeah, these are baby steps in the face of such horrifying death tolls in Syria. Of course, we want it to happen faster. But the fact is that it is happening. And, you know, a few months ago, nothing was happening at all.
Indeed, the destruction of Syria's chemical weapons has stalled. And US Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel has said that he is concerned about the situation. What do you think he can do?
Not a lot, in truth, other than give press conferences saying that. And clearly what's been going on in the last 24 hours is that he's been saying things. Somebody's been briefing where the organisation is meeting. The Prohibition of Chemical Weapons has got a meeting coming up. Somebody's been briefing from then. So, you know, and again, that's part of the game as well, I guess. You know, if you can make Syria look bad, maybe you're trying to put pressure on them to give a ground. It's all part of the same bigger picture, I think.
Do you agree? More widely even, what can the West do?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's right. I mean, he's obviously said, hey, we may be behind schedule, but it's still not too late. We still can meet the target, which is exactly what you want him to say. I mean, you don't want him to say, actually, this is doomed and we should give up now. So he's making the right noises that it is possible to make in this context.
And if he were to accept that it was, you know, it wasn't going to work, it wouldn't look good for his president, who kind of, you know, this got him off a hell of a hook, which was, you know, going to a war with Syria. Mm. So, you know, they want this plan to work, but at the same time, they've got to keep the pressure up.
Shall we leave Syria for now and turn to Egypt? As the violence increases and the election of General al-Sisi seems increasingly likely, Saudi Arabia seems content with the current regime as a matter of fact, so much so that it has pledged to give the country up to $4 billion in aid. Rachel, let me come to you first. Obviously, Saudi Arabia is relieved that the Muslim Brotherhood is out of picture, but that is not good news for democracy, is it?
No. Saudi Arabia is very, very pleased that the Muslim Brotherhood is out of the picture. And in fact, you know, giving this aid is a way of kind of cementing its approval and making sure that this very undemocratic military regime that is now in place in Egypt stays there. Saudi Arabia obviously playing a wider game. It has its own interests, not just being terrified of the kind of Muslim Brotherhood influence spreading to Saudi Arabia and threatening the Saudi kingdom. But also it's playing power games. It wants influence in the region in its big power game with Iran. Having Egypt as a client state, Egypt with its big military, is obviously a huge advantage to Saudi. And, you know, it can throw vast sums of money around the region to this end, which is exactly what it's doing now in Egypt.
How big a difference can $4 billion make in this situation?
Well, I mean, potentially, it, you know, who knows how the money is going to be spent? I mean, is it going to be spent in some military war? Is it going to be spent on humanitarian or aid of some kind? But it's clear that the Sunni or the predominantly Sunni countries are getting behind the regime. I was intrigued to see that the former British Prime Minister Tony Blair, who's actually in Egypt at the moment, came out really in absolutely outspoken terms in favour of this government. So we have in a sense a group of people, some of whom espouse democracy, like Tony Blair, who seems to have a problem with a government that was democratically elected and believes it should have been overthrown by the military. And we've got other countries actually who've never bothered with democracy, so why even argue about it? And they have come behind this regime, this military regime. And clearly they're prepared to put their hands in their pockets to fund it as well.
It's quite a baffling alliance, isn't it? So sort of Blair and Saudi, though of course Blair did back Mubarak, so I suppose it's no surprise that he would be a proponent of undemocratic authoritarian regimes.
Absolutely. It's a very interesting group of people coming together now.
Yeah. Saudi Arabia is very wary of fundamentalism in the region, but where do you see Egypt being headed at the moment? Are we just going to a pre-Arab Spring situation?
Yeah, it really does seem like a reset all the way back to before the revolution, but worse. I mean, this is a regime that is clearly clamping down on any kind of form of dissent. Not only has it declared the Muslim Brotherhood to be illegal and a terrorist organization and banned it and arrested its leaders, but it's also cracking down on, free speech, on journalism. So many of the pro-revolutionaries who were part of the original January 25th movement to bring down the Mubarak regime are now in prison, thanks to General al-Sisi and the army. So it does seem like an extraordinary rewind and taken Egypt back several years.
Surely the people of Egypt are not going to take that easily, are they?
Well, in these sort of situations, there sometimes is a kind of exhaustion, fatigue sets in of just how long can we be on the streets for? And, the feeling goes kind of underground for a time and then suddenly it might suddenly explode. But the moment... for instance, we have this extraordinary situation where journalists from Al Jazeera English, some of them experienced Western reporters, are in jail charged with, I think, terrorist offences now.
Yeah.
But in a sense, you might think that would offend a whole series of potential supporters of the regime. But
what, like actually, Tony Blair?
Like Tony
for
Blair.
For instance.
But he doesn't
randomly
seem to. He doesn't seem to. So they are in a sense, they are pretty hardline on a series of fronts. And I suppose from their perspective, so far, so good.
Stuart, you mentioned there those detained Al Jazeera journalists. There are as many as 20 of them being prosecuted in Egypt at the moment, accused of damaging the country's reputation. Do you think in any way this is something that can make a difference in the way international media works in Egypt?
Well, I think it's. I'm trying to think of situations where even, for instance, in Cold War Russia, damaging the country's reputation was an offence for a foreign reporter. I mean, that's kind of what reporters do sometimes, isn't it? They go and find things which has the, not necessarily the intended effect, but actually quite often the effect of damaging a country's reputation. So, I mean, on this basis, you would be locking people up all over the world. I mean, almost every foreign correspondent is potentially going to damage the reputation of the country where they're living. So that's why I think people are so alarmed at these developments. Because, I mean, Al Jazeera English is, I think, a fairly trusted source. I wouldn't say that necessarily of Al Jazeera in Arabic, but Al Jazeera English, actually run by a number of people who used to work with me, mostly British journalists, I would say actually does a good job. It's won awards in Britain. So I think that their arrest has struck a chord amongst the media community around the world as being a significantly damaging step for democracy.
But it is absolutely chilling as well. I mean, the fact that these, as you say, perfectly legitimate and respected journalists are arrested. Clearly, the Egyptian military is trying to send out a message, not just kind of penalising and imprisoning these Al Jazeera journalists, but a message to the international journalism community saying, look, this is what is going to happen if, you know, you don't do what we say, basically. Very dangerous, very chilling.
We're going to take a short break now. You are listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Marco Sippi. Don't go away. Rachel Sharpe and Stuart Purvis will still be here when we return.
More gritty than pretty, Cape Town's reign as world design capital focuses on the problem-solving potential of design. As South Africa celebrates 20 years of independence, Monocle explores, in film, the city's design for social change agenda.
The death of Madiba has reminded us in many ways of our true transformation mission. And I think just seeing how the world mourned with us, revisiting what his early ambitions were, what his goals, what he stood for, gives us a sense of a mission. 20 years ago was just a starting line for us, and it's a marathon, it's not a sprint.
Live, design, transform life. Premiering in the film section of Monocle.com.
All around the world, Monocle 24's growing network of correspondents bring you the latest news, reportage and insight. From New York to Nairobi, Bamako to Berlin.
For Monocle in Paris, I'm Tom Burgess-Watson.
For Monocle in Berlin, I'm Kimberly Bradley.
For Monocle in Pristina.
In New York.
In Cairo.
In Sao Paulo.
I'm Guy Delaunay.
From Monaco.
From Monaco.
In Tel Aviv.
From Monaco.
In San Francisco.
In North Vancouver.
In Ramallah.
I'm Aisha Spears.
I'm Joseph Dan.
From Monaco, I'm Sheena Rossiter.
In Bogota.
In London.
Bangkok.
Buenos Aires.
So, whether you want to know what's happening in the corridors of power, in the boardrooms of the aviation giants, or the must-sees at the latest film festival, stay tuned to Monocle 24. Monocle 24, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Still with me are Rachel Sharpe and Stuart Purvis. The next item I wanted to discuss with you both is rather good news for journalism. Amazon founder Jeff Bezos, who's now the owner of The Washington Post, has announced a huge investment for the paper. The editorial budget has been bumped up, new political reporters are being hired, a new breaking news desk will be created, as well as a new Sunday arts and style section. Bezos has described the change as his first mark on the paper, but the change comes just a week after the announcement that The Post is losing one of its most popular and prolific writers, Ezra Klein. Stuart, if I come to you first, do you think this announcement comes as a response to Klein leaving the Post?
Not necessarily. I mean, everyone's been fascinated ever since Bezos bought the paper as to what he was going to do with it. Soon after he bought it, I happened to bump into an old friend who was a senior figure in, let's call it, the Washington Post family. Mm-hmm. He was very upbeat about Bezos buying the paper. He thought that was good news. He thought that certainly some of the commercial management needed getting rid of, and that Bezos would bring a new commercial attitude. I think somebody said that Bezos bought the Post to make more of it rather than make less of it. And I think so far that's true. I mean, from the way the new appointments look, for instance, there's so much competition now in Washington from websites, the political websites, that I'm not surprised they've kind of beefed up their politics. On the other hand, beefing up the Sunday magazine, I mean, that also seems to make sense. Even in the circulation figures show that even while weekday newspapers sales are going down quite quickly, weekends with magazines are holding up better because people like the kind of, they like to hold the magazine and read it at a weekend. So I can see why he's doing it. I think it's good for journalism that he's doing it.
Do you think this is indeed going to work? Do you think Bezos is going to manage to make the Washington Post profitable?
I mean, he's, you know, if he can't, you wonder who can, to be honest. I mean, you know, he's the man who's got the model for making online projects work. And he does seem to have invested in the right places. You know, I do think the worry is, and I know, you know, it has been voiced before, is just how independent the Washington Post is going to be, whether Bezos has bought the paper and is investing in it purely, you know, altruistically because he wants to save journalism, or whether he just wants to buy himself more influence. And I worry that it's the latter. So great for journalists who are being employed by him, great for journalism, I don't know.
Mm-hmm. What do you think, where is the growth and increased revenue going to come from in the end?
Well, you have to say that you know, the paper and indeed the website have not been fully competitive, in truth, in recent years. I mean, something needed to happen. So there might be growth in just of catching up to where they arguably should have been. You know, the brand is very powerful, it's very well known around the world because of all the, you know, the stuff to do back in the days of Nixon, but actually, in truth, it hasn't been cutting the mustard. So I can see that there is room to actually just to get back to where perhaps it should be. But I mean, Bezos, because of his experience with Amazon, I think is able to kind of, you know, overuse cliche, think out of the box. And certainly, my source was saying that he was coming up with all sorts of different ideas, and surprisingly, using Amazon, things he'd done at Amazon as being relevant. Now we might think, what the hell have the two got in common? But here's a guy who's built a business out of giving people what they want. Now, you know, sometimes journalists don't find it kind of, you know, beneath their dignity to give the readers what they want. But maybe that isn't such a bad idea.
Which makes me think about, like, is this going to be good journalism?
Yeah, I mean, if it's the Amazon model, OK, so what's that? It's employing people in exploitative factories, destroying the book industry and not paying its taxes. So, you know, is that the model that we really want for journalism?
As I understand it, for instance, one example that was given to me is that on Amazon, you can buy books from people other than Amazon. Mm-hmm. Now, when he first suggested that at Amazon, apparently people said, why would we do that? But his argument is, as long as I can get them inside my site, I don't care who buys and sells the books. Now, maybe there's a version of that on the internet that hasn't been fully exploited. Some people, you know, for instance, a BBC site does, to a certain extent, cross-promote to other sites. But maybe a kind of site of sites, maybe he has something like that in mind. I don't know.
Like an aggregator.
Yeah, maybe he wants to be an aggregator, yeah. But who can tell?
But anyhow, the time for this announcement is quite good, considering that just last week we got more bad news from the media world. CNN fires 40 senior journalists. Just last week, this news. It's kind of difficult to tell whether the media industry is going up or down now. Can you draw any conclusions?
Well, I mean, I know a bit about CNN. I used to be partners with them in various ventures. And the fact is that there's been a complete changing of the guard at CNN. And all the people who liked to run a news network have been replaced by people who probably would prefer not to run a news network. They'd like to run a factual channel. And so it's very interesting looking at the schedule, for instance, of CNN International, less news programs, more factual programs, let's call them that. Documentaries. There's a documentary called Black Fish, which they were behind, which I think is nominated for an Oscar. So they would see serious, you know, viewers of documentaries as being a lucrative audience. And the great thing about documentaries, you can show them over and over again, whereas a news program, you have to kind of spend money refreshing it. So I understand the logic, but if you want to keep calling it CNN and the world's news leader, you kind of have to turn up on the news occasionally.
The world's documentary leader.
That's it.
Not really quite as catchy, is it?
No.
And just finally, before we go, I wanted to reflect just quickly on a semi-tragic story out of Iran, that of Mahmoud Baziri, a well-known Iranian actor who has opened up about being forced into unemployment for 8 years for resembling former Iranian president Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. And yes, that is right. They don't only share a name, they also share the same physique. Does this story make sense in a way? Do you think that there would have been space for an actor posing as President Ahmadinejad during his years in power?
I just think President Ahmadinejad didn't want to leave there to be any doubt that somebody just did not want any, you know, the situation where somebody might suddenly turn up on the screen looking like him was not a situation he wished to contemplate. I was reading about this on an Iranian website and he said there's actually a word in Farsi for not being allowed to be on television. It kind of reminds me of McCarthyism blacklisting, you know, if you're on this list. Now, McCarthyism is done for their political views. This is simply done because the guy has a face like the president was.
But the thing is, I mean, I saw this story on the BBC site and there's pictures of Ahmadinejad and this guy. And actually, he doesn't look like Ahmadinejad. I mean, he's 10 years older. And you kind of think, but, you know, all that fuss and probably he'd appear on screen and nobody would make that connection. So it does seem particularly unfortunate.
Unfortunately, we have to leave it there. Rachel Sharpe, author of Not the Enemy, Israel's Jews from Arab Lands, and Stuart Purvis, Professor of Journalism at City University in London. Thank you very much for joining us here at Midori House.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres, essa é a Monocle 24.
Oi, London, this is Monocle 24.
Fra London, du er Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette er Monocle 24.
From London, this is
Londres. Orlando.
London. London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
There is plenty still to come on the second half of today's Midori House. We'll be in Nairobi with our correspondent Tristan McConnell. We'll talk books with Parul Segal from the New York Times Book Review, and we find out how a tax cut on Spanish art galleries has given wings to a new generation of creative entrepreneurs.
I think it's changing, it's more modern, it's starting to grow a lot, and art is starting to be something that people want to know about and want to learn.
But before we get started on all that, here is David Spencer with the World News headlines.
Marcus, thank you very much indeed. The White House has warned the Syrian government that it must intensify its efforts to transport chemical weapons to the port of Latakia. That's after a report that less than 5% of the arsenal's been delivered and that work to destroy the weapons has now fallen behind schedule. The president of Ukraine's defended his record in handling the country's political unrest, accusing the opposition of continuing to whip up the situation. Today's statement from Viktor Yanukovych criticising the opponents came shortly after it was announced he's on sick leave with an acute respiratory ailment. An Italian court is expected to deliver its final verdict in a high-profile murder case dating back to 2007 in the next hour or so. United States citizen Amanda Knox and her Italian former boyfriend are accused of killing 21-year-old British student Meredith Kircher. Pope Francis has continued his high-profile changes at the heart of the Vatican. He's accepted the resignation of Cardinal Attilio Nicora as president of the Financial Information Authority and replaced him with 66-year-old Bishop Giorgio Corbellini, who has a track record of reform within the Vatican bureaucracy. Doctors treating 7-time Formula One world champion Michael Schumacher are to begin lowering his sedation level to start waking him up from an artificial coma. The 45-year-old German's being treated for injuries suffered when he hit his head on a rock while skiing in the French Alps last month. Those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, David Spencer. Welcome back to Midori House live here on Monocle 24. The time is 22:32 in Moscow, 18:32 here in London and 16:32 in Rio de Janeiro. It is time now to check in with one of our correspondents around the world. Today we head to Nairobi for a chat with our man there, Tristan McConnell. Tristan, welcome to the programme. Shall we start with a new story about Church of England leaders writing to presidents of Nigeria and Uganda criticising anti-gay legislation? Do you think their voices will be heard?
I think it's hard to say whether the presidents of Uganda and Nigeria are going to pay a whole lot of attention to a letter signed by the Archbishops of Canterbury and York. But already it's picked up a fair bit of attention here in Africa. The reason being that a large part of the justification, if you like, for these sort of anti-gay laws that we're seeing in both those countries, as well as, you know, pretty strict pre-existing laws in many other African countries, is that it somehow is contrary to the Bible, is anti-Christian, and runs against traditional values. And so, you know, an outspoken statement from the leader of the Church of England is quite powerful in that respect. But of course, on the other hand, it may simply result in more people turning away from what's seen as a rather too liberal Church of England and going more towards the perhaps evangelical churches or even the Catholic Church, which has a much stronger stance, if you like, against homosexuality.
Considering all that, how do the churches in Nigeria and Uganda feel about their English counterpart?
Well, we'll have to see how the bishops in those two countries actually react. There's been no sort of official response from them so far. I mean, bear in mind the letter was only sent yesterday, so it's still early days. But let's not forget that, you know, the Archbishop of Canterbury is in the midst of an Africa tour at the moment, so I think the timing is quite significant in that respect. And, you know, there are a lot of people who still hold the kind of Christian religious beliefs that we see kind of waning in places like certainly in England. And so, you know, they still carry a fair bit of weight. And this is certainly an important addition to an ongoing and very lively debate that we're seeing across Africa at the moment about homosexuality and gay rights and legislation relating to that.
Tristan, what do you think is in the background of the backlash in gay rights in Africa? It seems that there's a lot of news coming from that continent about new anti-gay legislation, or at least discussions of it.
Yeah, I think there are a couple of things at play here. I mean, one is that you know, this has become something of a hot button issue in the Western media, and so more attention is being paid to, you know, a lot of legislation that has been existing really for decades here in Africa. I mean, homosexuality is illegal in roughly a third of African countries, and these new laws that we're seeing are really tightening up existing laws. But then the other aspect that we need to look at is the domestic political context here. And in Nigeria, it's it's been widely seen the passing of the law as an attempt to take attention away from some of the domestic political problems that President Goodluck Jonathan is feeling. And in Uganda, you know, it's a way to gather support from certainly from American church groups, which are well funded, and it also, you know, it also plays very well to a populist audience. You know, if you're trying to look for support, the fact of the matter is, and you know, a lot of gay rights activists don't like to admit this, but the fact of the matter is that, you know, the majority of ordinary folk in many of these African countries are, you know, very strongly opposed to homosexuality. And that's really what these politicians are playing to, is a mass support for this kind of legislation.
Let's move on to Malawi next. A trial looking into the biggest financial scandal in Malawi's history has begun in the country's capital. What exactly is the case there?
Well, it's emerging at the moment. I mean, it all sort of came to light in September last year when a junior civil servant was found with something like $250,000 in cash in the boot of his car. And a few days after that, a senior official and the finance minister was shot three times in the head, but incredibly actually survived. And that kind of blew the lid on this scandal that's been dubbed Cashgate in the local media there. And what it looks like is that something around about $100 million worth of government money has been siphoned off, either through payouts to fictitious retirees through ghost pension payments, or else through services to companies that never actually provided any service to the government. And already something like, I think, 68 people have been charged. The trial began yesterday, but was swiftly adjourned. But what this points to is a really kind of rot at the heart of President Joyce Banda's government, and that's been very disappointing for Malawians who'd hoped for a change from the corrupt practices of the past government, and also very disappointing to, you know, the foreign donors who pay about 40% of the Malawian budget and now seeing huge quantities of that money being stolen.
Thank you very much, Tristan. That was Tristan McConnell, Monocle's Nairobi correspondent. Up next, we'll be in Spain to find out how the art scene is renovating itself. Stay tuned to find out more on this edition of Midori House on Monocle 24.
Should cities ban the car? Can we make truly sustainable metropolises? What happens if neighbourhoods lose their corner shops? How do you put a stop to suburban decay? Do children belong in big bad capitals? Can Detroit be saved? Can Sydney become a cycle capital? Can we learn to love concrete? And are rich cities always boring? If you want the answers to the big questions facing our cities, you need to tune in to The Urbanist, Monocle 24 Radio's weekly show about the cities we live in. Expect global reports, great interviews, passionate debate, and some surprises too, because drag star taxi drivers, love motel owners, and retail rebels also get their say. Presented by me, Andrew Tuck, The Urbanist premieres every Thursday at 1900 hours London time, and you can also download it from monocle.com or iTunes.
Welcome back to Midori House with me, Markus Hippi. 2040 in Helsinki, 1840 here in London, 1340 in Washington, D.C. We head over to the Iberian Peninsula now, where in recent days, the Spanish art scene has been celebrating a rare piece of good news on the heels of a report illustrating the terrible effect of a tax hike on local galleries since 2012. The government has announced a surprise reversal of its policy, bringing the rate down from a staggering 21% to a more reasonable 10%. Many galleries had been complaining that the harsh bump in their prices was forcing their customers to buy from neighbouring countries. But that is not all. A new project, the Atelier des Jeunes, created by a pair of young Madrid-based Argentinian entrepreneurs, has responded to the crisis in kind. They have decided to bring the gallery to the customer instead. Launching their own online gallery, they have stocked its virtual walls with some of Spain's best artists, illustrators, and graphic designers. Not confining themselves to cyberspace, the gallery has also embarked on a series of exhibitions in the real world, which is where Monocle's Madrid correspondent talked to co-founder Francisco Lalan and participating artist Guillermo Terrell to see how the project is helping to give up-and-coming artists a leg up.
The origin of the project was to support art and Spanish young artists, and we thought with the crisis and everything there wasn't too much opportunities for Spanish young artists, and there were like a lot of creative things happening, and we wanted to bring all that together and give them like a space where they can promote themselves and show the world or maybe what they were doing.
And what about the name? Tell me why you chose a French name if it's such a Spanish project.
It means a youth workshop. It was like we did a brainstorming and it happened. It was like thinking about art and everything and young people.
Tell me about the project, because it's an online gallery, but we're at a physical exhibition today, and it's the third of potentially many. Why is it important as well to have a physical exhibition and not just exhibit the work in the virtual world?
Well, first of all, we gather like together like a lot of artists that are young, and these young artists, like, they manage a lot of different languages. Like, they go from online drawings, illustration, painting, and everything. We started making like exhibitions not only online but in different spaces, just such as galleries like today, but also we make in Bilbao in a store that it was a closed store. So we try to go through different spaces, and also we think that maybe there are people that like and they get along with the online thing, but also there are people that they need to see the work and they need to see that these prints are really, really good quality and that they're signed and then their number.
And the works have been selected by quite a prestigious jury as well. Can you tell me a little bit about who was on the jury and how they went about selecting the works?
Well, the thing is, all the artists are selected by my partner, my business partner, Pato. He selected, and each artist presented five artworks. and then they go to a jury that is, well, composed by Juan Gatti, that is a very Argentinian but based in Madrid like for 30 years now. Very important graphic designer. He had worked with Almodóvar. Then Luis Venegas, that he's the one, the editor of Candy magazine. Rafael Doctor, that he has managed some galleries and museums, very important. Then Lucas Arraut, that is one of the editors of the most important newspaper here in Spain, that is El País, and the editor of the AD magazine.
I'm Guillermo Turrell. I was born in Madrid. And I lived in London for 4 years. I studied graphic design in Central St. Martin's and also did foundation there. And I'm an illustrator and a painter.
And what about yourself as an artist? What attracted you to this project and has it helped you?
Yeah, it's helped me a lot to get recognition in my work. And also it's been great because I met a lot of artists from Spain because I lived in London for 4 years. So I didn't really know that many Spanish young artists that are around my age.
You were living in London for 4 years. Mm-hmm. What made you decide to come back with such a grim situation for young people? Why come back to Madrid?
Because I had to come back home. That's the reason.
You're
why,
forced.
Mainly. Yeah, I was forced by my mother to come back. Okay. But yeah, I really love it here now because of this project. And it's changing a lot, actually, because when I left Madrid, it was pretty different 5 or 6 years ago. So I think it's changing. It's more modern. People are more getting more influences from other countries, and it's starting to grow a lot. And art is starting to be something that people want to know about and want to learn.
A lot of commentary you hear these days is complaints about the youth brain drain, that a lot of young people are leaving Spain and that they may not come back. But you decided to come back. Do you think your experience outside of Spain has actually helped you, and do you think you've been invigorated and perhaps have come back with new skills that can benefit Spain?
Yeah, definitely. I think so. I love living in Madrid now. I lived living in London, but I do love Madrid, and it's very inspiring to see the changes and how young people are so creative here now. The school there and their universities, the concept is very different because they're more free. They don't have any theory. I didn't have any theory in my university, so it's all about practicing and doing the work and doing research and looking at other artists and also going to galleries. And really, there's so much art there, so that's helped me.
The thing is that the Atelier de Junts wanted to do something that it was first to give the opportunity to young artists to show their work. The other one was to promote art, and the other one was to break down the myth that to buy good art, maybe you have to be rich.
We see a lot of these projects all around the world, online galleries. Has the majority of your customers, have they been from Spain?
Fortunately, we have a lot of people from Spain, but not only in Madrid. We are based in Madrid, so we have people from Madrid, but people from all over Spain. Even in Canarias, we're having some purchase. And also we are having, like in Europe, a lot of purchase. Then if we, like, for example, look at the analytics and everything from the website, we have people all over the world entering the site and everything. But at the moment, we are having, for example, a lot of purchase from London.
The government, many months ago, increased the value-added tax on art sales, and it really hurt the art sector. But just last week, announced that they were going to reduce the value-added tax back down to 10%. Will this have a positive effect on your business?
Well, I think yes, and I think it will have a positive effect in all artists because it encourages galleries, artists, and everything that works with this to produce more, to go there and maybe launch a business like we are doing and everything. So I think it's a very, very positive measure.
So a cause for celebration.
Yes, 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 totally.
That was our Madrid correspondent Liam Aldo speaking to the co-founder of the Atelier de Jeunes in Madrid, as well as to artist Guillermo Terrell. And it's time now for a bit of music. We just heard about art in Spain. Let's stay on that track with a band from San Sebastian that has chosen a very artsy name. This is La Oreja de Van Gogh. Yes, that means Van Gogh's ear, with Otra vez me ha sacado a bailar.
Serás el tiempo y el lugar de un verano nada peculiar.
Se muere por verte, se muere por ti.
From San Sebastian, that was La Oreja de Van Gogh with Otra Vez Me Ha Sacado a Bailar. You are listening to Midori House here on Monaco 24. We are fast approaching the end of the programme, but before we go, time for our daily review segment where we go through the best in books, theatre, art, music and cinema with our correspondents and contributors around the world. Today joining us from our New York bureau is Parul Segal from the New York Times Book Review. Parul, welcome to the show. You have three books that you would like to talk about today, and the first one is called The Triple Package. It is by Amy Chua and Jed Rubenfeld. How would you describe the idea of this book?
Well, Chua has this unerring instinct, I think, for cultural sore spots. And in this book, she and her husband, both Yale law professors, argue that certain ethnic groups have traits that allow them to succeed, and specifically in America. So she looks at Asians, Indians, Cubans, the Lebanese and Nigerians. And she says that they possess three particular traits. They have a group superiority complex, an insecurity about one's status, and impulse control. So naturally, this is ruffling a lot of feathers, and as her books tend to do. And it's being met with like a lot of criticism from both the groups that she derides, like poor rural whites, as well as African-Americans, and from Indians themselves. Suketu Mehta, the author of Maximum City and an Indian immigrant to America, calls her book a new form of racism.
I think that's really interesting that you tell about the findings of Amy Chua there, considering that in the U.S., It's kind of a thing that's learned over there, that self-esteem is really important. Feeling good about yourself is important to have a successful life. And this kind of goes completely against it.
Right, absolutely. Absolutely. It's totally against this feeling of complacency. There's an emphasis on work. There's an emphasis on effort, some of which can seem very, you know, her approach. There's always an element of, you know, this sounds like common sense. But I think the linking of these sort of traits with inherent cultural attributes makes people nervous.
So do you think our listeners can read this book and try to learn something from that on how to become even more successful?
Well, I think that's certainly Chua and Rubenfeld's aim. I think that their book is actually both like a sociological study of these various ethnic groups and their rising fortunes in America, as well as a sort of self-help book that says, you know, if you want to mimic, you know, this kind of success, this is what you can do. And they do make like an admirable effort in sort of breaking down those, you know, steps you can take.
Parul, did you enjoy reading this book yourself?
Oh, it's hard not to enjoy her. She's a provocateur. So, I mean, even when you disagree, there's still a lot that you can, there's a lot that just feels different and fresh and, you know, always provocative.
It almost seems that we have a theme today when we talk about these books, because the next book you will talk about is about why Asian and Asian American students consistently perform so well on standardized tests.
I know. I was astonished to find myself choosing so many books about raising children and parenting. I'm not a parent. But I think all of these books that I did want to talk about have something to do with anxiety. And that to me is interesting, cultural anxiety. So this book is by a Chinese-born writer and professor named Quan Yu Huang. And he takes issue with Chua. You know, he says that her 2011 book, Battle Hymn of the Tiger Mother, in which she said that, you know, Chinese parents are strict and get more results than, you know, American parents who tend to coddle their children. So he criticizes it by saying that, you know, Chua's perspective and her methods aren't particularly Chinese. And instead, he offers a sort of melding, a blending of East and West. So how can we balance what Chinese parents are excellent at, you know, sort of getting their children to understand that, you know, to appreciate the hard work and, you know, you don't have to quit doing something because it's not fun, with, you know, an American emphasis on individuality and exploration.
And when looking at this book, do you think there is a lot that can be learned from there?
I think so. I mean, I think he's actually like a very lovely writer. He, you know, is sort of self-deprecating. He talks a lot about the mistakes he's made. He talks a lot about, I think, some of that essential anxiety, you know, what to do, how much to hover, how much to guide.
The name of that book was indeed The Hybrid Tiger. And to continue with the third book, this is something I've been waiting. This is a great idea for a book. So often there have been books that have examined the effects of parents on their children, but this book, All Joy and No Fun by Jennifer Senior, actually goes completely against and asks what the effects of children are on their parents.
and it isn't good.
No?
I'm very fond of this book, but it is a very, very honest and blunt book. And essentially, she's exploring what she calls the paradox of modern parenthood. So why is parenting the thing that seems to give people so much meaning? But studies suggest that in the moment, we don't seem to enjoy it very much. And, you know, we actually, like in studies where they've asked people to rate, you know, amounts of satisfaction, people consistently put rearing their children behind housework, behind washing the dishes. And again, she ties this to this idea that, you know, what we consider childhood is childhood is a very young invention. It's about 70 years old. And, you know, for the first time in history, children are what she calls economically worthless, but emotionally priceless. And we are in this sort of lacuna. We don't really know what our jobs are. We don't really know what our responsibilities are. And so she,
And in the end, looking at the conclusions of the book, the effect children have on their parents, how positive is it in the end?
Oh, it's so positive. She says that parents are both so much more miserable and so much happier than non-parents.
And when you read that book yourself, did you enjoy it? And do you recommend that for our listeners as well?
Oh, I recommend it so highly. It's incredibly blunt. It's she follows families over the courses of a few years. She offers snapshots. I think it'll help people feel less alone, and I think it'll also it sort of like enhances a lot of the sort of existential questions people have, parents or not parents, about responsibility, about obligation and freedom.
Exactly. Sounds like this is the book you should read when you are considering of possibly becoming a parent sometime.
Absolutely.
Thank you very much, Parul Segal. And that is all we have time for on today's edition of Midori House. My thanks in particular to our special guests, Rachel Sharby and Stuart Purvis, and of course to Parul Segal too. Today's show was produced by Daphne Denis, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Anna De Situma. Our studio manager was Alex Funnell. Next, we'll be joining Andrew Tuck for The Urbanist. This week's theme is DIY, and he'll be hearing from the people taking it upon themselves to improve their cities.
Initially, we did this stuff assuming that we would get thrown in jail because we were literally breaking laws, you know, painting the streets, you know, putting in businesses that weren't supposed to be here. What happened was city staff came out and they said, you know, look, this is great.
Midori House will be back at the same time tomorrow at 1800 hours London time. But for this edition of Midori House, it's goodbye. Thank you for listening.
It tells the story of a passion for motor racing. A legend forged over time by the pioneers of speed and great drivers. The Daytona Cosmograph. The watch made to break barriers. The watch dedicated to endurance. The watch that was born to race. Rolex.